Today is Friday, the 14th of October.
Hello, it's Debbie back again on Wednesday, October 19th, 2016, with part two of the e-edition of the Decatur Herald and Review, starting with the obituaries. Sutton, Decatur. Robert K. Sutton, 72, a Decatur, passed away on Friday, October 14th, 2016, in his home. Services to celebrate Robert's life will be 11 a.m. Friday, October 21st, at Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home. Visitation will be for 1 hour prior to the services. Memorials are suggested to the American Diabetes Association. Owenico, Burner. Shirley M. Burner, 80, of Owenico, Illinois, passed away peacefully October 16, 2016, in Springfield Memorial Hospital with her family by her side. Funeral services will be 10:30 a.m. Thursday, October 20th, in Sites Funeral Home, Assumption, Illinois. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 Wednesday, October 19th. Okay, so that's this afternoon. Burial be in the Pleasant View Cemetery, Assumption. Memorials may be made to the donor's choice. Shelbyville, Freer. Ross A. Freer, Sr., 73, of Shelbyville, Illinois, formerly of Stonington, Illinois, died at 11:09 Sunday, October 16, 2016, at his residence. Funeral services will be held at 10 a.m. Friday, October 21, 2016, in Howanyaki Funeral Home, with Reverend Rena Witcher officiating. Visitation will be from 5 to 8 p.m. Thursday in the funeral home. Burial will be in the Glenwood Cemetery, Shelbyville, Illinois, with flag presentation by the Shelby County Honor Guard. Memorials may be made to the Shriner Hospitals for Children. 11. O-Z-E-E. Judy K. O.Z., 74, of resident in Mason Point in Sullivan, Illinois, passed away at Decatur Memorial Hospital in Decatur on Sunday, October 16th. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 on Thursday, October 20th, also at McMullen Young Funeral Home. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Friday, October 21st, also at McMullen Young Funeral Home, with Pastor Ryan Martin officiating. Interment will be at the Marrowbone Cemetery in Bethany, Illinois. Memorials may be made in memory to her family. And that is the end of the obituaries for today. Back to the local briefs of Decatur, childhood development, panel on why the early years really matter. Discussion on early childhood development will be from 6 to 7 Friday, October 21st, in Central Christian Church on William Street. The event, sponsored by Baby Talk, is free and open to parents, caregivers, early childhood educators, and students. Panelists will be Amy Hilado, an independent research specialist and assistant professor at Northeastern Illinois University, Ann Statler, founding faculty member of the Brazelton Institute in Boston, and Claudia Quigg, founder of Baby Talk. President Patrick White of Millikan University will moderate. Next, Decatur Ag Cafe Luncheon. Chad Colby will be the featured speaker during the Greater Decatur Chamber of Commerce Ag Cafe Luncheon from noon to 1. Thursday, October 27th, a week from tomorrow, in the Beach House at Lakeshore Drive. Doors open at 11:30. Colby, who's the founder and owner of Colby Ag Tech, has become known as an expert on new agricultural technology with recommendations for practical applications. He is a leading advocate for unmanned aerial systems. Colby also works as general manager of farm equipment dealer Central Illinois Ag. Tickets are $20 in advance, and you can get them from the Decatur Chamber. End of the briefs and page A3. Foray to the top column for the sports section for today. Coaching matchup is mild versus spicy. Smith, Harbaugh do their jobs like polar opposites. Champagne, and this is by Mark Tupper. Lovie Smith is a low-key, laid-back, happy to skip the spotlight. Jim Harbaugh is a full-throttle front page, and if it helped him land a recruit, he'd sprawl naked in the public spotlight. These are the popular opposite head coaches this week when Smith and the Illini head to Ann Arbor, Michigan to meet Harbaugh and the Michigan Wolverines. During Illinois' bye week in late September, Smith ducked questions about where he'd go in his first off-campus recruiting jaunt since he took over the Illini in March. He was happy to walk in the shadows, not create a stir, as he tiptoed quietly around a couple high school campuses in Florida. During Michigan's bye week last weekend, Harbaugh made national headlines every single day. He went recruiting in California and made sure everyone knew he was at Antioch High School on Friday, checking up on a five-star running back who'd already committed to Alabama. At halftime, it was Harbaugh who announced the homecoming queen. The next day, at a high school game in Albany, California, Harbaugh volunteered to help on the chain gang while he checked out El Cerrito's heralded offensive tackle, Aaron Banks. Harbaugh said they offered him a tri-tip steak sandwich to help move the down markers, and he just couldn't resist. Fans at each game were mesmerized. Also last week, he and his wife, Sarah, showed up at the Ann Arbor Ruth's Chris Steakhouse to show their appreciation for a promotion that was still celebrating Michigan's 78-0 victory over Rutgers. The restaurant owner ran an ad promising Michigan's margin of victory would become the percentage off dinners that week. Wisely, he capped the offer at 50%. But hungry diners lined up to devour half-price steaks, and in a conveniently staged photo, Harbaugh apparently ready to tackle a monstrous bone-in ribeye accompanied by a wine glass filled with milk. However, wherever Harbaugh goes, the campaign follows. Wherever Lovie Smith goes, he winces in a way that makes you... Winces in a way makes you believe he wishes the cameras would disappear. Different guy, different approach. I was there in Ann Arbor on December 30th, 2014, when Harbaugh was introduced as Michigan's new head football coach. It was the craziest introductory press conference I've ever seen, with lines of TV cameras stretched in multiple rows across the back of the room, looking very much like a football team lined up for its pregame stretch. The room was crackling with excitement as Michigan welcomed back its prodigal son, the one-time Wolverine quarterback who revered Bo Schembechler at Beckler, and who now has his own children attending the same elementary school where he walked the halls. If Harbaugh is one-man circus, Michigan Stadium is his big top, and it's here where, at 2:30 p.m. Saturday, Illinois will try to spoil what looks and feels like a Wolverine team sprinting to the daylight. Unless something goes terribly wrong, Michigan appears headed to an 11-0 start and an inevitable collision November 22nd with its undefeated rival Ohio State. Number 3 Michigan versus number 2 Ohio State. That game will be played in Columbus, Ohio, and no stadium in the land could contain all the hype and hoopla that will accompany that one. On the Big Ten's weekly teleconference call Tuesday, Harbaugh said he knew Lovie Smith professionally pretty well from their days at NFL head coaches. Smith was heading the Chicago Bears, and Harbaugh was coaching the San Francisco 49ers. I coached against them that one time in 2012, Harbaugh said. Ah, yes, that was an important season for each coach. Lovie Smith was headed to a 10-6 record, which nowadays sounds like a glorious season for the Bears. Trouble was, the Bears fired him at the end of that year. Harbaugh was headed for the Super Bowl. His 49ers beat Smith's Bears 32-7 and would go on to lose to Harbaugh's brother John and the Baltimore Ravens in the Super Bowl. Two years later, Harbaugh was done with the 49ers in part, some say, because his eccentric style had an accumulative effect that people found exhausting. That's why college, especially Michigan, could be the perfect landing spot for Harbaugh. Players cycle through every 4 to 5 years. The Ann Arbor faithful adore him, and his energy to stay in the recruiting spotlight seems to know no bounds. On Tuesday, Harbaugh praised the job Smith is doing in his first season with the Illini. They're improving, he said. It should be noted that he also praised Rutgers a few days before the wipeout that wrote another Ann Arbor headline, "Welcome to Half-Price Steaks." End of that sports article, and probably the end of what we're going to read from the sports page. Now we're at C1, the money page for, or money section for the Cato Herald and Review, Wednesday, October 19th. August 2017, closure for Mattoon lamp plant, says the headline. No viable alternatives to decision suggested. This is by Rob Stroud, Lee News Service writer. Mattoon. GE Lighting has informed employees at the Mattoon lamp plant that a final decision has been made to close the facility by the end of August 2017. The announcement on Thursday followed, quote, an idea generation period, unquote, with employees exploring cost savings alternatives to the closure, said GE Lighting spokeswoman Alicia Gower. Quote, ultimately, no viable solutions were found to offset dramatic and continuing decline in volume for the products produced at this plant, unquote, Gower said. On August 11th, GE Lighting announced plans to phase out operations at the Mattoon Lamp Plant on South 19th Street by late August 2017 unless, quote, the idea generation period, quote, unquote, yield an alternative to closure. GE Lighting reported that in the last decade, the lighting industry has seen a major technology pivot away from traditional lighting products, including incandescent, halogen, and specialty linear fluorescent lamps. Consumer demand for traditional lighting is at an all-time low, and that shift has been supported by the U.S. government phasing out incandescent bulbs, GE Lighting reported. The company reported that as a result, volumes down dramatically at the Mattoon lamp plant, and the facility is operating 60% below capacity, which is not sustainable. Gower said the remaining 148 employees remaining at the plant, nearly 38%, are eligible for retirement. All other employees are eligible for GE's plant closing benefits of severance pay, continued medical, dental, and life insurance coverage for the employee and his or her covered dependents, tuition reimbursement for education and retraining, and preferential job replacement at up to 12 GE locations. The company reported that its goal will be to use the long lead time before closure to help the Mattoon lamp plant employees make a successful transition. Regarding GE's long-term plans for the Mattoon lamp plant property, Gower said the property may have uses for other manufacturing or commercial operation, but it's too early to speculate. End of Stroud's article. Continuing, Social Security recipients get 0.3% raise, increase less than $4 a month for average person. This is by AP Press writer Stephen Olemacher. Washington, millions of Social Security recipients and federal retirees will get a 0.3% increase in monthly benefits next year, the fifth year in a row that older Americans will have to settle for historically low raises. The adjustments add up to a monthly increase of less than $4 a month for the average recipient. The cost of living adjustment announced by the government Tuesday will affect more than 70 million people, about one in five Americans. For recipients, the average monthly Social Security payment now is $1,238. Unfortunately, for some seniors, even the small increase will probably be wiped out by an expected increase in Medicare Part B premiums, which are usually deducted from Social Security payments. By law, rising premiums for most Medicare recipients cannot exceed their Social Security cost of living increase. That's known as a hold harmless provision. However, new enrollees and high-income retirees are not covered by that provision, so they could face higher Medicare premiums, which will be announced later this year. There was no Social Security benefit increase this year, and next year's will be small because inflation is low, driven in part by cheaper fuel prices. The low inflation rate should help keep some older folks' bills from rising very rapidly. Don't tell that to Millicent Graves, a retired veterinary technician who says Medicare and supplemental insurance premiums eat up nearly a third of her $929 monthly Social Security payment. The 72-year-old from Williamsburg, Virginia, says her insurance premiums went up by $46.50 this year, and her cable TV, internet, and phone bill went up, too. I just lose and lose and lose and lose, Graves said. More than 60 million retirees, disabled workers, spouses, and children get Social Security benefits. The COLA also affects benefits for about 4 million disabled veterans, 2.5 million federal retirees and their survivors, and more than 8 million people who get supplemental security income. The disability program for the poor. Many people who get SSI also receive Social Security. Since 2008, the COLA has been above 2% only once. In 2011, it's been only once in 2011. It's been zero 3 times. End of that article. Continuing, robot pilot idea clear for takeoff. Government, business, see benefits, but pilot union skeptical. This is by Joan Lowy, AP writer. Manassas, Virginia. Think of it as the airborne cousin to the self-driving car, a robot in the cockpit to help human pilots fly passengers and cargo and eventually even replace them. The government and industry are collaborating on a program that seeks to replace the second human pilot and two-person flight crews with a robot co-pilot that never tires, gets bored, feels stressed, out, or gets distracted. The program is funded by the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, the Pentagon's arm for development of emerging technologies, and run by Aurora Flight Sciences, a private contractor. With both the military and airlines struggling with shortages of trained pilots, officials say they see advantage to reducing the number of pilots required to fly large aircraft while at the same time increasing safety and efficiency by having a robot pick up the mundane tasks of flying. The idea is to have the robot free the human pilot, especially in emergencies and demanding situations, to think strategically. It's really about a spectrum of increasing autonomy and how humans and robots work together so each can be doing the thing that they're best at. It is best at, said John Langford, Aurora's chairman and CEO. Langford even envisions a day when a single pilot on the ground will control multiple airlines, liners in the skies, and people will go about their daily travels in self-flying planes. At a demonstration of the technology at a small airport in Manassas, Virginia, on Monday, a robot with spindly metal tubes and rods for arms and legs and a claw hand grasping the throttle was in the right seat of a single-engine Cessna Caravan. In the left seat, a human pilot tapped commands to his mute colleague on an electronic tablet. The robot did the flying. Sophisticated computers flying planes aren't new. In today's airliners, the autopilot's on nearly the entire time the plane's in the air. Airline pilots do most of the flying for brief minutes during takeoffs and landings, and even those critical phases of flight could be handled by the autopilot. This program, known as Air Crew Labor and Cockpit Automation Systems, or ALIAS, goes steps further. For example, an array of cameras allow the robot to see all the cockpit instruments and read the gauges. It can recognize whether switches are on or off position, can flip them to the desired positions, and it learns not only from its experience flying the plane, but also from the entire history of flight that's in that type of plane. The ALIAS robot, quote, can do everything a human can do, unquote, except look out the window, Langford said. Give the program time and maybe the robot can do that too, he said. In other ways, the robot is better than the human pilot, reacting faster and instantaneously, calling up every emergency checklist for a possible situation, officials say. In some ways, it'll be like flying with, quote, co-pilot genius, unquote, Langford said. Quote, the robot carries in them the DNA of every flight hour in that aircraft system, every accident. It's like having a human pilot with 600,000 hours of experience, unquote. The robot is designed to be a drop-in technology ready to use in any plane or helicopter, even 1950s vintage aircraft built before electronics. But the robot faces hurdles before it's ready to start replacing human pilots, not the least of which is that it would require a massive rewrite of FAA safety regulations. Even small changes to FAA regulations often take years. End of that article. And finally, on the front page of the money section is the Stu Ellis column, Dannon Ads at Odds with Goals. Farmers, food processing companies, and consumers are all big boys and girls. They can make decisions, and in this nation of food abundance, consumers have the opportunity to make whatever choices they want in feeding themselves and their family. Unfortunately, some unseemly marketing ploys will get in the way of transparency in an effort to hornswoggle consumers who may not know any better and think label trickery is legitimate. Suppose he has an opinion on this. Let's see. The latest Shame on You award has been presented to Danon, the yogurt makers, by a coalition of agricultural groups wanting the consumer public to know that Danon is playing a dirty trick on them. The U.S. Farmers and Ranchers Alliance, along with some of its member groups, the American Farm Bureau Federation, American Soybean Association, American Sugar Beet Growers Association, National Corn Growers Association, and the National Milk Producers Federation, have protested to the head of U.S. operations for Danon about the way the company's new pledge to consumers is being promoted. The Danon pledge states that, quote, the company will work with dairy farmer partners and suppliers to implement sustainable practices and technology to improve soil health, increase biodiversity, decrease carbon emissions, and manage water better, unquote. Additionally, the company will phase out GMO and synthetic feed over the next 3 years, and finally, by December 2017, the company plans to label the presence of any GMO ingredients in its product. Quote, the agriculture group may be disappointed, but acknowledges the company's decision about phasing out GMO-based feed products for dairy cows is the company's own decision. And if the company can find enough milk to make yogurt under that policy, then the company is fortunate. What rankles the ire of the farm group is the more recent Danon advertising making claims that it's doing to improve agricultural sustainability. The groups have responded by saying, quote, your pledge would force farmers to abandon safe, sustainable farming practices that have enhanced farm productivity over the last 20 years while greatly reducing the carbon footprint of the American agriculture, unquote. The American Soybean Association wrote, during the last 20 years, advancements in the agricultural technology have allowed farmers to use less pesticides and herbicides, fossil fuels, and water, and to prevent the loss of soil to erosion. Taking away this technology is akin to turning back the clock and using outdated technology to run a business. The farm groups and the Danon company are at odds over the term sustainability, and both obviously have different definitions. Danon's definition may be locked in the mind of a Madison Avenue copywriter who has a negative view of GMO products for whatever reason and knows all about cows because there was a picture of one on a Danon label. Agriculture's definition of sustainability is the complex process of producing food that could evolve into perpetual motion. With the use of a genetically modified seed, there will be no need to apply insecticide to protect the crop since the crop will do it itself. Under the Danon philosophy, the application of insecticide and other pesticides are preferable to genetically modified corn that would be fed to cows to produce the milk that make the yogurt. The farm group's letter to Danon said, we strongly support open, honest, and transparent engagement with consumers and the right of the customers to make informed choices about the products they buy. But we are troubled by the disingenuous approach embodied in the Danon pledge. Separately, President Richard Wilkin of the American Soybean Association said, quote, Danon isn't competing in good faith. Danon is making false marketing campaigns, to boost the sale of its products. We can't afford to stand by and allow this technology to be further denigrated by untruthful claims like Danon's. Let's see. Are there Danon's products in the refrigerator? Not anymore. End of the article by Stu Ellis. Stu Ellis is an observer of the Central Illinois agricultural scene, says the note at the end there. Going to the front of the life section, little short, Dylan out of reach. 5 days after Bob Dylan was named the winner of the Nobel Prize in Literature, no one knows how he feels about the prestigious award, not even the Nobel judges. The Swedish Academy, which bestows the annual honor, says it hasn't been able to reach Dylan since the award was announced last Thursday. We haven't established direct contact with Bob Dylan yet, but I have spoken to one of his closest associates, the Academy's permanent secretary, Sarah Danius. Danius told the AP in an email on Tuesday. The Academy hopes he'll accept the invitation to collect his award at the annual Nobel ceremony in Stockholm on December 10th. Under the headline Literature Honor, the University of Maine is creating the Stephen E. King Chair in Literature in honor of its most famous graduates. in honor of one of its most famous graduates. King graduated from the university in 1970 with a degree in English. The university is collecting applications from English professors to fill a position now. The appointment is set to begin in August and is a 5-year renewable term. The university says the position is tenured and designed to honor the University of Maine's English department's most celebrated graduate. The school says the position will have undergraduate education as central focus. End of that article. Under the headline, CPR, a lifesaver for teen. MacArthur student survives cardiac arrest with help from granddad. This is by Justin Kahn, staff writer for H&R. Decatur, July 11th began like any other summer day for 16-year-old Hannah Breen. She got up, attended an acting summer camp, posted photos to Facebook, and was getting ready for dinner when she suddenly collapsed. Breen doesn't remember any of it. She just remembers waking up in the hospital lucky to be alive. Breen is alive because of the experience of a 9/11 operator, firefighter, and paramedics who responded to the emergency and doctors at Decatur Memorial Hospital and St. Louis Children's Hospital for who cared for her for after. But there was another more unlikely hero, Hannah's stepdad, Chris Featherstone, who performed CPR until the paramedics arrived. Just 3 months before the incident, Hannah, Chris Featherstone, and Hannah's mom, Liz Featherstone, will be participating. Just 3 months since the incident, Hannah, Chris Featherstone, and Hannah's mom, Liz Featherstone, will be participating in the Macon County Heart Walk on Saturday. Her team is hashtag HBS Strong. We want to do this to support Hannah and also to raise awareness of heart disease, sudden cardiac arrest, and CPR, Liz said. It's important for people to know they can save a life by doing compressions. Less than a week after Hannah was released from the hospital, the entire family was trained in CPR by a friend who works at the Macon County Jail. But other than what they'd seen in TV and movies, no one in the family had any previous experience with CPR on the day Hannah collapsed. Hannah had no previous health issues and is active in theater and music. On July 11th, she was feeling particularly tired after participating in the district's Best of Summer Stock youth theater program and went to her room to take a nap. Chris had awakened Hannah so she could get ready for dinner. A couple minutes later, Chris heard what sounded like something falling in Hannah's room. He went with Hannah's older sister, Erica, to check on her, and she was on the ground near the chair. She sat in to do makeup and hair. We went in to try to get her to respond, but she wasn't. She was breathing awkward. I thought maybe she'd followed and punctured a lung. We didn't know what to do, so we called 911. The 911 operator, Krista, lay Hannah on her back and performed CPR. She had to walk me through every step, Chris said. You see it on TV and think no big deal, but when you actually have to do it, it's a whole different thing. It felt like it was happening in slow motion. The 9/11 operator explained where Chris should place his hands and how to do the compressions. He put the phone on speaker and performed CPR while listening to the operator's instructions. Chris estimated he'd finished between 20 and 30 compressions when firefighters arrived and took over. The doctors told her they believed Chris getting the compression started is what saved her life. Soon after firefighters arrived, the paramedics got there and determined Hannah was in cardiac arrest. They gave her a shock with a defibrillator, then rushed her to the DMH. Soon after, she was airlifted to St. Louis. Liz was at the St. Louis airport, arriving there after a business trip into Baltimore when she got the call from Chris about 6:15. That made Chris promise he'd take good care of the kids so I could go on the trip. It was with that thought in mind when Chris called Liz. The firefighters and the paramedics were still there, and I came out to the kitchen, called her, and tried to fill her in with as much information as I could, Chris said. It's not something you think you're going to have to call and tell someone. You put me in charge of your child now, and they're collapsed, and you're performing CPR on her. Hannah was in the hospital for 2 weeks and surgery was performed to implant a defibrillator. She only remembers the last 3 days post-surgery. She was diagnosed with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, though long QT syndrome is also a possibility. It's a complicated case. So that's the end of that article that we're going to read. It's the end of part two of the Decatur Herald and Review on Wednesday, October 19th, 2016, as read by Debbie. Talk to you again soon.